mentioned you had your experience with the industry, but now you're just chilling here. But is there anything you want people to know that we haven't talked about?
As far as like what to, you know, parting comments or anything like that, if you go see plays or if you go see movies or if you go see television, if you have any interest in the industry at all, wonder what it, and the only reason I'm in this business is because I always wondered when I watched a movie, how did they do that? Who got to make that thing? That is so cool. And then at some point, the door opened for me that said, you can actually do that. And I looked at my tools and my skill set and I said, my gosh, that is actually something that I might be able to do. Mm-hmm. And when I tried that, it was in fact what I wanted to do. And people told me, hey, you're good at this. So, it was, next thing you know, we're 35 years later.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Ben Carter, CMU shop instructor.
Yep.
It's super fun being able to work with you. I know I work for DR technically, but
that's
just
right.
Coming in and being able to see you all the time, talk to you
cool.
about the dogs. But yeah, thank you so much.
Yeah, anything I can do to help, let me know.
Yeah. All right. Cool.
Forbes Avenue is a production of WRCT Pittsburgh.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
Now, what's happening today is incommensurably worse. It's directed entirely against every institution, every activity that takes place on campuses, and universities have no idea how to combat it.
As a tumultuous spring semester finally comes to a close, we speak with Professor Ellen Schrecker, who studied McCarthyism's impact on higher education for half a century. She says universities in the age of Trump are now facing a situation worse than McCarthyism. Then Trump vows to go to the Supreme Court to keep his tariffs in place after a whirlwind 24 hours that saw a court temporarily reinstate the measures soon after two courts blocked most of the tariffs, saying Trump overstepped his presidential authority.
The courts should have no role here. There is a troubling and dangerous trend of unelected judges inserting themselves into the presidential decision-making process. America cannot function if President Trump, or any other president for that matter, has their sensitive diplomatic or trade negotiations railroaded by activist judges.
We'll get response from the Brennan Center, then to Reagan attorney Bruce Fein on the slew of pardons Trump has issued this week.
I think the common pattern in the recent pardons by President Trump are that all the recipients have assisted him either through money directly or indirectly, politically, and they all seem to have a common thread of some type of fraud or cheating involved, very similar to the 34 felonies Trump himself was convicted of in New York.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Israel issued new forced displacement orders for residents of northern Gaza and parts of Gaza City as its assault on the Palestinian territory enters its 601st day. The order set off a panicked evacuation of staff and patients at the Al-Auda Hospital, which was the last functioning hospital in North Gaza. Health officials say Israeli attacks on hospitals have killed more than 1,400 medical workers since October 2023. On Thursday, Israeli attacks across Gaza killed at least 70 Palestinians. Airstrikes since dawn today have killed a further 18 people, according to Gaza hospital officials. Al Jazeera reports Israeli troops shot and wounded 20 Palestinians trying to reach an aid distribution point set up by the shadowy U.S.-Israel-backed Gaza Humanitarian Foundation. It's the third aid center set up by the group so far. The United Nations has said the foundation's decision to open a handful of aid hubs exclusively in the south of Gaza Strip puts civilian lives in danger and encourages mass displacement by using aid as bait. Meanwhile, Gaza's food crisis continues to worsen, as the trickle of aid now entering the territory is far too little for its population of over 2 million people. This is Kala Abu Zetar, mother of an 11-month-old child suffering from malnutrition, who said she did not manage to get a meal after waiting in line at a soup kitchen in Gaza City Wednesday.
This boy is suffering from extreme malnutrition. The average weight for his age is 12 kilograms. Now he only weighs 3.9 kilograms. He has been granted a medical evacuation 20 days ago, but I'm still waiting.
On Thursday, the White House said Israel had agreed to a U.S.-crafted Gaza ceasefire proposal and that Trump's Middle East envoy, Steve Witkoff, had submitted it to Hamas. Drop Site News reports the deal includes a 60-day initial truce, a redeployment of some Israeli occupation forces, and an exchange of captives, including 10 living Israelis held hostage in Gaza. It would also require the immediate delivery of humanitarian aid, including by the United Nations and the Red Crescent. Hamas officials said they were studying the deal, but a member of the group's political bureau told Reuters the proposal in its current form would result in, quote, the continuation of killing and famine in Gaza. Israel's military has intensified its airstrikes on southern Lebanon in further violations of a ceasefire deal agreed to in November. On Thursday, an Israeli drone strike killed a municipal worker operating a water well near Lebanon's border with Israel. Separately, one person was killed by Israeli gunfire in the Lebanese border town of Kfar Kila. President Trump's newly named envoy to Syria raised the U.S. flag over the ambassador's residence in Damascus Thursday for the first time since its closure in 2012. Thomas Barrack's visit to the Syrian capital comes just weeks after Trump lifted sanctions on Syria, prompting the European Union to follow suit. Saudi Arabia's defense minister warned leaders of Iran last month they should accept President Trump's offer to negotiate a new nuclear agreement with the United States or face military action by Israel. That's according to Reuters, which reports Saudi Prince Khalid bin Salman personally delivered the message that Trump's team would want to reach a deal quickly, that the window for diplomacy would close fast, and that an Israeli attack was possible if the talks broke down. Khalid bin Salman's visit to Iran in April was the first by a high-ranking member of the Saudi royal family in more than 20 years. A federal appeals court Thursday temporarily reinstated Trump's sweeping global tariffs, staying a decision by a trade court that had blocked those tariffs one day earlier after finding Trump overstepped presidential authority by invoking emergency powers. Prior to Thursday's stay, another federal court, this time in Washington, D.C., had also blocked Trump's tariffs. The case is expected to make its way to the Supreme Court. Trump's trade war has roiled global markets and already cost companies $34 billion, according to Reuters. A number of smaller businesses have been forced to shutter. We'll have more on this story with the Brennan Center's Elizabeth Goitin later in the broadcast. Mexican voters are gearing up for the first ever judicial election Sunday after a contested reform last year ordered the elections despite vocal objections from the legal sector. Critics warn it'll make judges more vulnerable to corruption and organized crime. Ahead of the past several weeks, operating drones meant to kill gang members. A Haitian human rights group blames the drones for the deaths of over 200 people. In Canada, authorities in Manitoba and Saskatchewan have declared states of emergency and ordered residents to evacuate as dozens of wildfires burn. The current forecast for dry conditions and high winds could further stoke the infernos, with smoke expected to drift into Midwestern U.S. states. The daughter of a woman who died during the 2021 Pacific Northwest heat wave is suing seven oil and gas companies for her mother's wrongful death. Juliana Leon died of hyperthermia, or overheating, as a heat dome choked the region and sent temperatures in Seattle skyrocketing to 108 degrees Fahrenheit. Nearly 200 people died during the heat wave. The lawsuit's the first of its kind and accuses the fossil fuel companies of concealing their role in creating the climate crisis and failing to warn people of the dangers of their emissions. This comes as a new report today found half the world population endured 30 additional days of extreme heat over the past year due to human-created climate change. The Supreme Court has sharply limited the scope of the National Environmental Policy Act, a ruling that'll accelerate the development of major infrastructure projects, including highways, pipelines, and liquefied natural gas export terminals. The court's 8-0 ruling on Thursday will allow federal agencies conducting environmental reviews to take a more limited view of the impact of major transportation and energy projects. Earth Justice said in a statement, quote, "The Trump administration will treat this decision as an invitation to ignore environmental concerns as it tries to promote fossil fuels, kill off renewable energy, and destroy sensible pollution regulations," unquote. Meanwhile, President Trump's Environmental Protection Agency has drafted a plan to completely eliminate limits on greenhouse gas emissions from coal and gas-fired power plants. That's according to internal agency documents seen by the New York Times, which reports the EPA has determined emissions of carbon dioxide, methane, and other greenhouse gases, quote, "do not contribute significantly to dangerous pollution," unquote. A court in Germany ruled against a Peruvian farmer who was seeking redress from the energy company RWE for its role in the melting of Andean glaciers, which has put the farmer and his community in Juarez at risk of flooding. But climate activists are celebrating the ruling as a major victory, as the German court also found major polluters can be held responsible for the consequences of climate change, setting up a possible precedent as similar cases play out in other countries. This is German lawyer Rode Verheyen, who represented Saul Luciano Yuya in the landmark case.
But what is important is the legal obligation of companies like RWE has been established here today. The legal obligation to deal with the consequences of their actions and to bear responsibility for them is something that has never before been established anywhere in the world in this form.
A major report on chronic health conditions by Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. was found to contain citations to non-existent studies. The 73-page Make America Healthy Again document contains references to at least seven fabricated studies, while other studies are misinterpreted. This comes as the health department has just canceled a $600 million contract with Moderna to develop mRNA vaccines protecting flu subtypes, which could develop into pandemics, including bird flu. RFK Jr. has expressed skepticism over mRNA technology, which was used in COVID vaccines that are widely credited with saving millions of lives and preventing millions of cases of severe disease. The ACLU and other groups are suing to block a new Texas law that'll require public schools display a copy of the Ten Commandments in every classroom. Texas Governor Greg Abbott has vowed to sign the bill, which the Texas Senate approved on a vote of 28-3 Wednesday. The ACLU called the measure blatantly unconstitutional. Here in New York, a judge extended a temporary restraining order protecting Columbia University student Yancio Chung from deportation until a hearing on June 5th. She is a South Korean national, a green card holder, who's lived in the United States since she was 7 years old. She's been targeted by immigration authorities for participating in Palestinian rights protests at Columbia. Community members rallied in support of Chung as her lawyers appeared in court Thursday. This is Yunmi from the group Notital.
She's being attacked because she has views that go against the Trump administration and their desires in Israel, and also against the general ruling class. So by persecuting her on also baseless grounds, there's no evidence against her. Who can say what the Trump administration and the federal government are willing to do next to anyone, regardless of their immigration status?
Longtime New York journalist Tom Robbins died Tuesday at the age of 76. For over four decades, Robbins' work exposed the dark side of New York institutions, including corrupt politicians and landlords and abuse inside prisons. He wrote for The Village Voice, City Limits, The New York Times, and The City. To see our interviews with him, go to democracynow.org. In Texas, Ronnie Duggar, the founder and longtime publisher of the Austin-based Texas Observer, died this week at the age of 95. The Texas Observer, which started in 1954, exposed political corruption and racism in Texas and championed anti-war and civil rights struggles. Duggar and his reporting has been credited with helping catalyze a progressive movement in Texas. And the renowned Kenyan author, playwright, and professor Ngugi wa Thiong'o has died at the age of 87. Over six decades, he chronicled Kenya's transition from a British colony to independence. His work landed him in jail and in exile as he wrote searing criticisms of colonial rule as well as the emerging independent state, which he accused of benefiting elites at the expense of Kenyan society. In 2010, I interviewed him at the Democracy Now! Studio after he just released his memoir, Dreams in a Time of War.
In all the settler colonies like Kenya, Nigeria, Kenya, South Africa, and Zimbabwe, Mozambique is another example, Algeria is another example, independence was won through armed struggle. In all of those, there was armed liberation movements, and the land question was at the basis of the whole struggle. So with Kenya, we had one of the earliest anti-colonial guerrilla movements. Ours was by the name of Mau Mau.
To see our interview with him in full, go to democracynow.org. Again, that's Ngugi wa Thiong'o, who has died at the age of 87. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. President Trump's crackdown on academic institutions in the United States was the focus of protests and commencement speeches this week. As universities like Harvard held commencement ceremonies, the Trump administration's now directed federal agencies to review all contracts with Harvard after it already canceled nearly $3 billion in federal research grants for the university and moved last week to revoke its ability to enroll international students. Harvard has two separate suits pending against Trump, arguing the moves violate due process as well as free speech protections under the First Amendment because they target the university's staff, curriculum, and enrollment. In his address at Harvard's commencement ceremony Thursday, Stanford University professor, doctor, and novelist Abraham Verghese praised the school's defiance of Trump and spoke to students facing threats of deportation or having their visas revoked.
When legal immigrants and others who are lawfully in this country, including so many of your international students, worry about being wrongly detained and even deported, perhaps it's fitting that you hear from an immigrant like me. Perhaps it's fitting that you hear from someone who was born in Ethiopia when it was ruled by an emperor, someone who then lived under the harsh military leader who overthrew the emperor, someone who had at least one of his medical school classmates tortured and disappeared. More than a quarter of the physicians in this country are foreign medical graduates. So, a part of what makes America great, if I may use that phrase, is that it allows an immigrant like me to blossom here, just as generations of other immigrants and their children have flourished and contributed in every walk of life, working to keep America great.
That's the novelist and medical doctor, Ethiopian Indian American Dr. Abraham Verghese, addressing Harvard's commencement ceremony on Thursday, his latest book, The Covenant of Water. Meanwhile, down the road in Cambridge, the Indian American class president at MIT, the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, spoke about how MIT's undergraduate body and graduate student union had voted overwhelmingly to cut ties with Israel. Megha Vemuri wore a red and white keffiyeh said MIT students would never support a genocide and praised them for continuing to protest despite, quote, threats, intimidation, and suppression coming from all directions, especially, she said, your own university officials.
Last spring, MIT's undergraduate body and graduate student union voted overwhelmingly to cut ties with the genocidal Israeli military. You called for a permanent ceasefire in Gaza. And you stood in solidarity with the pro-Palestine activists on campus. You faced threats, intimidation, and suppression coming from all directions, especially your own university officials. But you prevailed because the MIT community that I know would never tolerate a genocide. Right now, while we prepare to graduate and move forward with our lives, there are no universities left in Gaza. We are watching Israel try to wipe Palestine off the face of the earth, and it is a shame that MIT is a part of it. The Israeli occupation forces are the only foreign military that MIT has research ties with. This means that Israel's assault on the Palestinian people is not only aided and abetted by our country, but our school. As scientists, engineers, academics, and leaders, we have a commitment to support life. Support aid efforts and call for an arms embargo and keep demanding now as alumni that MIT cuts the ties.
That was MIT class president Megha Vemuri, now Indian American graduate of MIT. This comes as Jelani Cobb, the dean of Columbia University's Graduate School of Journalism, another school facing attacks by the Trump administration, writes for The New Yorker magazine this week about how, quote, academic freedom in the United States has found itself periodically under siege. In his piece headlined, "A Tumultuous Spring Semester Finally Comes to a Close," he describes how he consulted with Ellen Schrecker, a historian and the author of No Ivory Tower, McCarthyism and the Universities, along with other deans at Columbia. They spoke about government repression on college campuses in the 1950s through to the present. Schrecker told him, quote, "I've studied McCarthyism's impact on higher education for 50 years. What's happening now is worse," he quoted her saying. Well, we begin today with Ellen Schrecker in person joining us in our New York studio. She's the author of Many Are the Crimes, McCarthyism in America, No Ivory Tower, McCarthyism and the Universities. Schrecker's also the author of The Right to Learn, Resisting the Right-Wing Attack on Academic Freedom. And she just wrote a piece for The Nation headlined Worse Than McCarthyism, Universities in the Age of Trump. Schrecker has been active in the American Association of University Professors, AAUP, since the 1990s. I should note she has 3 degrees from Radcliffe Harvard and formerly taught there. She's a graduate of Radcliffe, 1960. Ellen Schrecker, welcome to Democracy Now! It's great to have you with us. As we look at these universities under attack, you've studied higher education for over half a century. Let's talk about what was happening then and what's happening today.
Okay. The main thing that happened then to universities was that about 100 faculty members, most of them with tenure, were fired and blacklisted. That happened in every major institution of civil society within the United States. And although the universities pride themselves on academic freedom, whatever that means, they collaborated with the forces of repression through that were actively imposing a climate of fear and self-censorship throughout American society. Today, what's happening is worse, so much worse that we have to really find a new phrase for it. I don't know what it'll be. But during the McCarthy period, it was attacking only individual professors and only about their sort of extracurricular political activities on the left in the past and in the present, then present. Today, the repression that's coming out of Washington, D.C. it attacks everything that happens on American campuses.
I'd like you to start off. We have a very young audience. We also have their parents and their grandparents around the world. And I'd like you to start off by talking about who McCarthy is. What do we mean by the McCarthyism of, for example, the 1950s?
Okay, that's a very good way to start. Because McCarthyism, unfortunately, is misnamed. It is not just the career of Senator Joseph McCarthy, who came in onto the stage of history in 1950 after the ism that he gave his name to had been really dominating American domestic politics since the late 1940s. 47 is when the Truman administration imposed a loyalty test, an anti-communist loyalty test on its employees. So if we wanted to name this phenomenon of political repression, anti-communist political repression, and I want to specify that it didn't attack randomly people on the left, but very specifically people who had some kind of connection, usually in the past, with the communist movement. That during the 1930s and 40s was the most dynamic force on the left, even though it was a very flawed political group. It was nonetheless very influential on the left. And if we wanted to give that political repression of the 1940s and 50s a name, it should have been Hooverism, after the FBI director J. Edgar Hoover.
You know, the movie Good Night and Good Luck, they showed real black and white footage of McCarthy, and test audiences thought he was too harsh, unrealistic, not realizing it was actual footage. And now you have Good Night and Good Luck on Broadway, George Clooney starring in it. And it is the financially most successful Broadway show we've seen, is going to be now for free on CNN in a few days. But the significance of that what people feel today was a cartoon character was in fact much harsher and sharper than people ever dreamed.
Yeah. He was beyond the pale because, like the current president, he had no guardrails, as it were.
Not to mention Roy Cohen, his sidekick in the hearings, who would later go on to mentor Donald Trump until at the very end of his life, Donald Trump rejected him when he was dying of AIDS.
Exactly. So there are lots of similarities with the fact that there's this very aberrant character at the heart, or at the sort of public heart of this repressive movement. But what we should have known in the 40s and 50s and should know now is it's not just a one-man show. It has been this moment of trying to crack down on dissent, constitutional dissent, free speech, the ability to say what Israel is doing in Gaza is a terrible thing. That is something that has been building up for decades. And that was the same thing during McCarthyism. There was a kind of network of right-wing activists, similar to groups today like the Heritage Society that brought us the 2025 project blueprint for Trump's attack on the institutions of civil liberties and civil society, that has come to fruition since he entered the White House.
So, I mean, you speak as a Jewish author, active member of the American Association of University Professors. Would you say that the McCarthyism of yesteryear is the charges that President Trump, with his sidekick Elon Musk giving the Heil Hitler salute, charging anti-Semitism for what he's doing?
Anti-Semitism is a pretext. We know that. Trump has been all his life a racist, clearly befriending these fascist individuals and groups for years. And what we're seeing is a kind of a melding of Trump's own right-wing proclivities, reactionary proclivities, pro-fascist proclivities, with a long-term attempt within some pro-Zionist organizations to eliminate all support for Palestinian freedom and Palestinian liberation from American universities. In particular, but from within American society.
You have earlier this month, the federal judge Jeffrey Crawford ordering the release of Columbia University graduate Palestinian activist Mohsen Madawi from prison in Vermont. He was picked up by masked, hooded ICE agents at his naturalization interview in Vermont. He was beyond holding a green card. The judge writing in his ruling, quote, "Our nation's seen times like this before, especially during the Red Scare and Palmer raids of 1919, 1920, and during the McCarthy period of the 1950s. And I wanted to take it beyond that. You note that, you know, that we're not just talking about individual professors anymore. We're talking about current attacks being much broader. And you write that this interesting paradox, quote, "Despite higher education's much larger footprint within American society, today the academy is in a much weaker position to resist political intervention." Why is it weaker?
It's weaker for two reasons. One, because the state is stronger. The state does much more in with regard to higher education than it did in the 1950s. You know, it supports most important basic scientific research. It regulates things on campus with regard to, shall we say, diversity, equity, and inclusion, with trying to ensure that all Americans have a good shot at higher education. That was a push by the federal government. So you can see that the government is much more involved. It funds student loans. Most smaller universities without huge endowments rely on students who have to get federal loans in order to pay tuitions. So what he's doing by withdrawing federal money from higher education is essentially threatening to destroy American higher education today.
I wanted to turn to the clip of Secretary of State Marco Rubio speaking in March following the arrest of the Columbia graduate student, now graduated graduate student, albeit he was in jail in Louisiana when he got his diploma at Columbia, Mahmoud Khalil.
If you tell us when you apply, "Hi, I'm trying to get into the United States on a student visa. I am a big supporter of Hamas, a murderous, barbaric group that kidnaps children, that rapes teenage girls, that takes hostages, that allows them to die in captivity, that returns more bodies than live hostages." If you tell us that you are in favor of a group like this, and if you tell us when you apply for your visa, "And by the way, I intend to come to your country as a student and rile up all kinds of anti-Jewish student, anti-Semitic activities. I intend to shut down your universities." If you told us all these things when you applied for a visa, we would deny your visa. I hope we would. If you actually end up doing that, once you're in this country on such a visa, we will revoke it. And if you end up having a green card, not citizenship, but a green card as a result of that visa while you're here and those activities, we're going to kick you out.
of course, the Trump administration not proven any of this. And a number of students have been released from prison with very angry judges talking about where are the grounds for these people to be imprisoned. Mahmoud Khalil has been now imprisoned for 3 months as his little baby was born here in New York. If you can talk about what this leads to, these kind of harsh attacks when it comes to speech and when it comes to universities. You were just addressing the deans at Columbia University. Some compare Harvard not fighting back against the Trump administration and Columbia conceding and the pressure it's put on its students.
Yeah, this has been a constant in the history of American higher education to collaborate with political repression. Universities do not fight back. They didn't fight back during the McCarthy period. We're not fighting back until this miracle. It really was a miracle, totally unexpected, of the president at Harvard saying, no, I cannot go along with what you were asking. And what they were asking...
The Jewish president at Harvard,
Jewish, right,
Alan Garber, who President Trump has accusing of anti-Semitism.
Well, of course, we're all anti-Semites, as long as we feel that maybe you shouldn't be killing babies in Gaza every day. But what we're seeing is the beginning of a pushback against what Trump is doing, what his entire apparatus of hoodlums, I think, is trying to do to the universities. And that wonderful quote you had from Secretary of State Rubio when he said, you know, paraphrasing these supposed terrorists, that they wanted to shut down the universities. He's doing more to shut down the universities than probably anybody else in America at this moment.
Threatening to revoke the visas of
exactly.
all international students. What about the role of your organization, the AAUP, the American Association of University Professors?
Right. We are a group that is over 100 years old, and when we were founded, it was a period very much like today, where outsiders, politicians, and especially very wealthy business people on boards of trustees were interfering with what faculty members were saying and doing with regard to, at that point, there was a lot of labor unrest and attempts to create unions. And university professors were sort of saying, well, look at the working conditions under which American workers are being oppressed. Let's do something about industrial accidents and things like that. Today, we're seeing that in every way, the federal government, state legislators, interfering with the academic work of university professors. And that is what my organization is trying to do, is to protect the integrity and the educational value of what goes on American campuses.
Do you hold out hope in this last minute we have together?
Yes. Because, unfortunately, we have no model we can follow from McCarthyism because there was no pushback. But today we're seeing people marching to commencement at Harvard, wearing labels saying, you know, enough is enough, President Trump. We're seeing huge crowds showing up to welcome Mohsen coming back from Vermont after having been picked up by ICE. We're seeing a growing movement within civil society that has to be maintained and has to be maintained for years. I mean, the damage that the Trump administration is doing is absolutely beyond the pale and has never, never been equaled in American life with regard to higher education. So we've got to get out there in the trenches and even begin to think some more about, okay, if they're not paying attention to the judges, if the Supreme Court folds, and let us pray that it does not, what do we have to do?
We're going to have to leave it there. Ellen Schrecker, author of Many Are the Crimes, McCarthyism in America, No Ivory Tower, McCarthyism and the Universities, also the author of The Right to Learn, Resisting the Right-Wing Attack on Academic Freedom. We'll link to your piece in The Nation, headlined Worse Than McCarthyism, Universities in the Age of Trump, as well as Jelani Cobb's piece in The New Yorker that extensively quotes you, Ellen Schrecker, at democracynow.org. When we come back, President Trump vows to go to the Supreme Court to keep his tariffs in place, even though court after court is challenging them. We'll get an update from the Brennan Center in 30 seconds. Thanks so much for being with us.
Recoge solo tus ideas, levanta para acá tu mirada para todo lo que venga.
Me está llamando.
El día que amanece lento, recoge solo tus ideas, levanta para acá tu mirada para todo lo que venga.
Me está llamando.
Semilla que va germinando, paciencia que el enfoque llega, el tiempo que flota en el aire, las horas al viento se entregan. Semilla que va germinando, paciencia que el enfoque llega, el tiempo que flota en el aire y el viento se entrega.
Me está llamando.
De a poco te zafas del miedo, un dedo tras otro lo sueltan, en tu pecho una llamarada que por dentro quema. De a poco te zafas del miedo, un dedo tras otro lo suelta. En tu pecho una llamarada que todo lo quema. Te está llamando. Y me está llamando. Óyelo. Y un fuego que todo lo quema, un fuego que todo lo quema. Responde que te está llamando, responde que te está llamando. Un fuego que por donde quema, un fuego que todo lo quema. Y un fuego que todo lo quema, y un fuego que todo lo quema.
Flame Calling by Maku Sound System here at Democracy Now! Studios. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. We turn now to Trump's sweeping global tariffs. After a whirlwind 24 hours that saw a federal appeals court Thursday temporarily reinstate the tariffs, just a day after the U.S. Court of International Trade blocked most of the tariffs, arguing Trump overstepped his presidential authority by invoking emergency powers. Prior to Thursday's appeals court order reinstating for a few minutes these tariffs, a federal court in Washington, D.C. also blocked Trump's tariffs, though that ruling won't go into effect for another 2 weeks. The Trump administration's vowed to bring the legal fight to the U.S. Supreme Court. In its ruling, the New York-based Court of International Trade said the U.S. Constitution gave Congress exclusive powers to regulate trade with other nations, and that a 1977 law cited by Trump to invoke the tariffs, the International Emergency Economic Powers Act, did not give him the authority to levy the sweeping import taxes. President Trump denounced the attempts by the courts to block his tariffs in a lengthy Truth Social rant Thursday night that also targeted Leonard Leo, who, as a top member of the Conservative Federalist Society, played a vital role in influencing Trump's judicial picks during his first term, including the selection of three far-right Supreme Court justices. Trump wrote, quote, "Hopefully, the Supreme Court will reverse this horrible, country-threatening decision quickly and decisively. Backroom hustlers must not be allowed to destroy our nation." "I was new," Trump went on to say to Washington, "and it was suggested that I use the Federalist Society as a recommending source on judges. I did so openly and freely, but then realized that they were under the thumb of a real sleazebag named Leonard Leo, a bad person who in his own way probably hates America and obviously has his own separate ambitions." Trump went on to say, "I'm so disappointed in the Federalist Society because of the bad advice they gave me on numerous judicial nominations. This is something that cannot be forgotten," Trump wrote on social media and Truth Social. For more, we go to Washington, D.C., where we're joined by Elizabeth Goitein. co-director of the Liberty and National Security Program at the Brennan Center for Justice, expert on the International Emergency Economic Powers Act, the law Trump has invoked to justify his global tariffs. Welcome back to Democracy Now, Elizabeth. Okay, if you can respond to everything. First, explain what this court is that overturned the tariffs, said you can't use this law. And then even who Leonard Leo and the Federalist Society, who many may be shocked that Trump has turned on, given he helped choose three of the Trump appointees who were confirmed to the Supreme Court.
Sure. So there are actually two courts that have now rejected Trump's attempt to use emergency powers to essentially bypass Congress and impose worldwide tariffs. One of those courts is a regular federal district court here in Washington, D.C., and another court is called the Court of International Trade, which is a specialized federal court that hears challenges to laws involving trade or customs. The Court of International Trade heard the case with a three-judge panel. So we now have had four different judges, two of whom were appointed by Republican presidents, including one Trump appointee, and two of whom were appointed by a Democratic president. And all of them, so the Court of International Trade panel was unanimous, held that Trump exceeded the authority provided to him under law by imposing these tariffs.
And so go more deeply into this 1977 law and what it means to invoke an emergency.
Sure. The law is called the International Emergency Economic Powers Act, or IEEPA. And it is one of the 150 laws that become available when the president declares a national emergency. IEEPA requires the president not only to declare a national emergency, but also the powers that are available under IEEPA have to be used to deal with an unusual and extraordinary threat to the national security, foreign policy, or economy of the United States, and they cannot be used for any other reason. IEEPA has historically been used to impose economic sanctions against hostile foreign actors. It forms the basis for dozens of existing sanctions regimes, including our sanctions against Iran, North Korea, Venezuela, etc. But it has never previously been used to impose tariffs. And that is because while IEEPA includes a long list of powers that the president can exercise, that list does not include the words tariffs, taxes, or duties. So the government is instead arguing that language in IEEPA that allows the president to regulate economic transactions, including imports and exports, should be read to sort of impliedly authorize tariffs against every country in the world.
Let me ask
you. That is what the courts rejected.
The three-judge panel of the trade court also blocked a separate set of tariffs against China, Mexico, and Canada, which the Trump administration had imposed over what it claimed was a flow of illicit drugs and undocumented immigrants into the United States.
Right. And there was actually a separate reasoning for blocking those tariffs. So when it came to the worldwide tariffs, essentially what the court said is that the government was claiming unlimited power to impose whatever tariffs that the president thought would be appropriate. And that was such a massive sort of takeover of the powers that the Constitution gives to Congress. So Congress, under Article 1, has the authority. In fact, it's the first power listed under Congress's powers to impose tariffs. And if you read IEEPA to allow the president to make up his own mind about what tariffs should be imposed on what countries, that would be unconstitutionally transferring Congress's power to the president. The fentanyl tariffs that you mentioned against China, Mexico, and Canada were more limited. And so there was a different argument that was made in that case. What the plaintiffs argued was that under IEEPA, the powers have to be exercised to deal with an unusual or extraordinary threat, and that the terrorists in this case were such a total mismatch to the threat that had been identified, the threats of fentanyl trafficking and human trafficking and illegal immigration, that it just didn't meet the criteria for AIPA.
So
now in this case,
I'm going to interrupt. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, this is really important, which is why I'm not letting you interrupt me yet. What the government argued in this case was that no court can question the president's decision that his actions under AIPA are dealing with an unusual and extraordinary threat. And the Court of International Trade rejected this claim entirely. The court said that these criteria in the statute are clear and that the courts are capable of interpreting and applying them, and that this is the supremacy of the law requires that courts must be able to intervene when a president acts outside of the law. So that was a very important part of the ruling that will have salience far beyond this immediate case.
So you have Trump officials calling this a judicial coup. They're going to take it to the Supreme Court. What do you see happening?
Well, I think it might take a little while because there are several other lawsuits pending across the country on the tariffs, and there will be decisions in the lower courts, and then they will go up to the appellate courts. The appellate courts will have their chance to rule. Yes, this is headed towards the Supreme Court in the next term for the Supreme Court. And I don't think anyone can predict exactly what will happen, but I will point out that one of the arguments reasons that the Court of International Trade gave for holding that AIPA does not authorize tariffs was because such a reading of AIPA would violate the major questions doctrine. And that is a doctrine that the Supreme Court has really embraced in these last few years. Under this doctrine, any executive branch actions that have major political or economic significance must be clearly authorized by Congress. It has to be explicit. It cannot be a vague or ambiguous provision that is being interpreted to grant that power. That is certainly the case with the government's interpretation of AIPA. So there's a strong argument based on a doctrine that the Supreme Court has very much endorsed.
And before the Supreme Court, could the tariffs be blocked again? We just have 20 seconds.
Yes, it is possible. It's also possible, and I would argue probably likely, that the courts will continue to stay these decisions and allow the tariffs to go forward pending appeal. But I wouldn't bet a lot of money on that. It's very unpredictable.
Elizabeth Goitein, I want to thank you so much for being with us, co-director of the Liberty and National Security Program at the Brennan Center for Justice. Next up, Reagan attorney Bruce Fein on the slew of pardons Trump has issued this week. Back in 20 seconds.
I'll wave a hair string, riding in our wave. I'll wave a hair string.
History by Downtown Boys performing in our Democracy Now! Studio. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. We end today's show with a slew of pardons President Trump has issued, many this past week. In one case, Trump pardoned Scott Jenkins, a former Virginia sheriff and longtime Trump supporter, convicted on corruption charges after undercover video showed he accepted over $75,000 in bribes. In another case, Trump pardoned the former reality show couple, Todd and Julie Chrisley, after they were sentenced to long prison terms for evading taxes and defrauding banks of more than $30 million. The couple's daughter helped campaign for Trump. She requested the appeal on Fox News. This comes as Trump loyalist Ed Martin has a new role as the Justice Department's partner pardon attorney after he failed to win Senate approval to become District of Columbia's top prosecutor. For more, we go to Washington, D.C. We're joined by Bruce Fein, constitutional lawyer, former associate deputy attorney general and general counsel of the Federal Communications Commission under President Ronald Reagan, author of Constitutional Peril, The Life and Death Struggle for Our Constitution and Democracy. Bruce, thanks so much for joining us. Why don't you go through these pardons with us? Talk about the Virginia sheriff. Talk about the reality TV couple, what they were in prison for and what it means that they've been freed, not to mention fines worth millions of dollars being forgiven.
Well, in the two cases you mentioned, the sheriff was convicted of basically using his office to raise money through bribes, $75,000, to give favors to friends. The other case concerned tax evasion and fraud, the kinds of crimes that Mr. Trump himself has been under attack for. I think that if you look in the broader sense, Mr. Trump is trying to create an aura of incredulity about the legitimacy of the criminal justice system, at least with regard to the pardons of these slew of white-collar offenses and sometimes their political allies as well. We just learned today in the newspapers a former congressman, former governor of Connecticut, also pardoned. And I think that Mr. Trump recognizes that he's losing overwhelmingly in the courts now, and that's why he's even turning on the Federal Society and Leonard Leo, because he believes when he loses in the United States Supreme Court, he's going to need a political reason for why he's losing. And he's trying to cast aspersion, I believe, on the legitimacy of the entire justice system. That's why these pardons are not indiscriminate, because they're targeted to help people who are politically his supporters, raise money for him or otherwise, and which is very dangerous. I want to add this. The framers understood the possibility that the pardon power would be abused. There was an exchange in the Virginia ratification debate between James Madison and George Mason. And Mr. Madison, when Mr. Mason said, well, what if the president uses his pardon power to help his political friends? That could be very, very dangerous. Why are we endowing the president with such pardon power? And Mr. Madison said, well, if the president uses pardons to help his political friends or personal friends, certainly the House will impeach and he will be removed from Congress. Because it's very difficult for an individual citizen, you or me, to have standing to challenge a pardon. Unfortunately, Congress has turned into an inkblot. It has no spine. And so that remedy is gone, which I think underscores the importance, if we're going to have any kind of pushback, of public opinion saying we need the law to be enforced even-handedly.
I want to ask you about Paul Wolczak. In April, President Trump pardoned him, the Florida healthcare executive convicted of tax evasion, for stealing nearly $11 million in payroll taxes from the paychecks of doctors and nurses. The jury found him guilty after prosecutors show he used the money to finance a lavish lifestyle. Wolczak is the son of Betsy Fago, a healthcare entrepreneur and Republican Party donor. Trump pardoned Wolczak 3 weeks after Fago attended a $1 million a plate fundraiser at Mar-a-Lago. And he also pardoned forgave the fine of something like $4 million that he'd have to pay in addition to serving time in jail. The significance of this, Bruce.
Well, at least it has the appearance of bribery. You're raising money, and then shortly after you raise money, then comes the pardon. And we know at least one of the offenses that justifies impeachment is bribery, even if it's indirect. I think this is very dangerous. But I want to underscore, Mr. Trump is not the first one who's abused the pardon power. He's got to take it a different scale, I think. We have Joe Biden and Hunter Biden. We have, remember, Mark Rich and William Jefferson Clinton and Roger Clinton and even George H.W. Bush. He pardoned the Iran-Contra defendants, including Cap Weinberger. So it's been abused before, but it's taken to a scale now where it threatens to undermine the entire legitimacy of the criminal justice system. And you mentioned earlier Ed Martin, which is really quite alarming, since Mr. Martin said, I am going to use my position not to just go after people I think committed crimes, but to stigmatize them, even if we can't convict them. We want to harass them, make them lose their reputation. It's a danger that Justice Robert Jackson, a former attorney general, warned against in 1940 because the laws are very vague. And here we have a member of the Justice Department saying, we're coming after you, even if we can't prove they're guilty of a crime, just to harass you and give you a bad name. That clearly is an abuse of the obligation to faithfully execute the laws. Typically, you have an obligation in the Justice Department not even to begin an indictment unless you believe you can prove guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. And now we have a very, very low threshold for beginning an investigation that probably will go nowhere other than tarnish reputations.
Well, Bruce Fein, I want to thank you very much for being with us. You mentioned Martin. Politico reports Martin spent his first week on the job reviewing pardon applications of January 6th insurrectionists, including Oath Keepers founder Stuart Rhodes, seeking to have President Trump convert their commuted sentences into full pardons. Bruce Fein is constitutional lawyer, former Reagan attorney, was associate deputy attorney general and general counsel of the Federal Communications Commission under President Ronald Reagan. That does it for our show. Happy birthday to Angie Caron. And check out our website for full-time jobs, a senior headline news producer, director of audience, and director of technology. Go to democracynow.org/jobs. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.